Welcome to Solidity Galaxy Brain. My guest today is Will Papper. Will is a Solidity developer, co-founder of Syndicate, a platform for creating crypto investment clubs, and the creator of Adventure Gold, better known as AGLD. In this episode, we discuss Will's background researching mesh networks prior to getting involved in crypto, and how he came to learn about community management through a side project running Minecraft game servers. We dive into the Adventure Gold contract, and Will shares the story of writing AGLD in 4 hours while stuck at an airport. We discuss his aspirations for the project, the mechanisms he included in the code, and what he might do differently with what he's learned since then. We also discuss Will's main project, Syndicate, the crypto investment club tech that's already been used to launch thousands of DAOs since it launched only a few months ago. Will explains the lessons he and his team have learned about smart contract upgradability patterns and what makes managing Solidity engineering teams different from their Web2 equivalents. I had a great time chatting with Will, as always. This conversation was an inspiring reminder that blockchains give superpowers to optimistic devs willing to make new discoveries through playful experimentation. I hope you enjoy the show. Will, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks so much. It's absolutely fantastic to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited about today's episode. We met in person at NFT NYC last year, maybe going to hang out at this upcoming NFT NYC also. And it was really great to meet you in person. And I'm looking forward to chatting with you a little bit more about your experience in crypto, writing Solidity contracts, and everything that you're up to now.
Absolutely. It was a fantastic time and excited to dive in on the show.
Yeah, definitely. So, okay, start things off properly. What were you doing before you were involved in crypto at all? And when was that?
I got involved in the decentralization space in 2013. Actually, not through cryptocurrencies, but through mesh networks.
Oh.
So yeah, I love the space. Helium is pushing them forward. For a decade, they were super overlooked. But I was working for a summer at the MIT Media Lab, and I was working on mesh networking technologies and essentially focused on peer-to-peer data communication and essentially peer-to-peer infrastructure with no centralized party. It was ad hoc Wi-Fi mesh networks. So essentially, devices could broadcast a network that other phones could connect to. And then by connecting that network, they could exchange data. So I built a news sharing application, more of a prototype, on top of that mesh networking infrastructure. That was in 2013. I
saw something like along the lines of that being used in Hong Kong, like an iPhone app interface to such a thing. Was it the same type of technology?
The same type of technology, yes. So FireChat is the group that eventually productionized a lot of that technology. I was working on pure research. It was not ready for production use, but it was something that helped push forward a lot of these concepts.
Got it.
Mesh networks have started to see their way into the real world, and they're still, in my mind, a underappreciated and underutilized technology, but they are still absolutely fascinating to me, even if I'm mostly in a different area of the decentralization space now via cryptocurrencies.
The other one that comes to mind is it Mesh NYC that does a mesh network, like base stations on top of apartment buildings? If you're familiar.
Yes. Yeah. I haven't looked into them in detail. Yeah, it's very, very fascinating because there's a few different mesh network approaches. We're focused on mobile devices and flash memory SD cards. So essentially, pretty low bandwidth use cases, but things that could handle extremely intermittent connections. As long as you connected at some point while just walking around during your day, you'd be able to exchange all the data with a local node that you need to. Whereas there's options like Helium and I believe Mesh NYC, though I haven't looked into it in detail, that are much more focused on higher bandwidth use cases, trying to get closer to regular internet connections. So it's very interesting. I never made this connection before, but there I think there's some parallels in approaches to decentralization in crypto. Ad hoc mesh networks are kind of the highly, highly decentralized option, but it's also more slow and difficult to use. And then you have mesh networks that operate via more centralized nodes, and they have much higher bandwidth and can handle much more traffic. So it's very interesting. I never made the connection before that the degree of decentralization in a mesh network can also have impacts on the day-to-day use, just like the degree of decentralization of a blockchain network has impacts on the day-to-day use, but in exchange, you get a lot more security and resiliency. So I never made the connection before. It's a lot of fun.
It actually
seems like a ton of parallels.
Yeah, definitely. It does seem like the sort of most radically decentralized version, but at the expense of some of the benefits you get of having some shared state that everybody can have access to when they are connected to the network. It's interesting.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a completely fascinating space. I'd say that mesh networks, the current mobile operating systems, make it difficult. Reliable Bluetooth connections are really hard. Setting up personal hotspots on iPhones programmatically at the time was something you couldn't do. I believe you still can't do it. So our mesh networks only operate on Android devices, but you could hack up mesh networks with things like Bluetooth Low Energy. There are various technologies that are starting to bring them more mainstream, but on the highly, highly decentralized, low bandwidth side of things.
What drew you to that, and did it have any connection to what drew you into crypto in 2013, 2014?
So essentially, while working at the Media Lab in 2013, mesh networks, I started to fall down the cryptocurrency rabbit hole. So I saw that cryptocurrencies were a really other interesting application of a decentralized technology, and I started to hack on it on just evenings and weekends. So there's one project I made with a team at a hackathon, and that was, for example, verifying file hashes on the Bitcoin blockchain. So the idea was essentially you could take a file, hash it, turn that hash into a Bitcoin address, and then send a small amount of dust to that address. And then if you look up someone's address, let's say you look up an address that someone's published, just looking at all of the dust that they've sent to different addresses lets you tell which files are legitimate hashes or not. So that was just a fun hackathon project. And then I was also, at the time around 2014, trying to compile my own fork of the Bitcoin network. Back then, it was really popular for people to fork the Bitcoin source code, recompile it, launch our network, but some really tiny tweaks. Usually they decrease the block time, or they change the distribution schedule. And that was a pretty fun side project for people to do back then. And I was working on that just on my own, and I saw how difficult the process was. You had to dive really deep into the Bitcoin source code. You had to recompile everything from scratch. Then you had to launch a network and secure your own network via proof of work. So you had to find proof of work miners or run your own miners on it. And it was essentially just a hugely painful process. And I didn't have a particular goal in mind with making this fork. I was just thought to myself, oh, I want to see how difficult it was. And the answer was very difficult. I didn't end up launching the fork. But in that time, I discovered Ethereum. And I saw the pre-sale. And my entire thesis around Ethereum in 2014 was, oh, wow, you can launch your own token without needing to secure your own proof of work network. That was basically my whole thinking on it. Yeah, I know. It seemed super novel at the time. I mean, ERC-20s as a standard didn't exist. It was just, oh, you can create your own token. That's cool. So I essentially stopped working on the side project to fork the Bitcoin network and dove into the Ethereum white paper and started to learn more about it. I did not have much money to invest at the time. I was spending a bunch of money at the time keeping the game community running and didn't have much spare cash. So I just took the $10 I got for free from Coinbase for signing up. I had $10 in Bitcoin. I put that into the Ethereum presale and have been tracking the Ethereum ecosystem closely ever since. Put money into the original DAO in 2016. Saw a lot of the ecosystem develop and then started working on it in more depth in 2018 in the bear market, and then went full-time in the crypto space in January 2021 with Founding Syndicate.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it's only in 2021 that you really went full-time into building in this ecosystem.
Yep, and I also actually only learned Solidity in late 2020, early 2021 as well. So, I mean, I tracked the ecosystem closely. I was in this back in the day. There was a Solidity developers group chat in Skype. Just goes to show how how outdated it is. There's like 150 people in the group chat in like 2015, and Solidity was like super niche then, and there were barely any docs, and it was not as nice as Forkly opens up on contracts and builds something interesting. So I remained very aware of the ecosystem, but I started building it up full time more recently.
Wow, that's fascinating. So a couple things. What was the game community you were trying to keep running in the early part?
Yeah, so I don't recall the exact year I co-founded it. It must have been 2011 or so. I ran some game servers with some friends, essentially, you know, Minecraft, Team Fortress 2, games like that, like fun games to play with your friends. We stumbled into it actually completely accidentally. We had been playing games on a friend's game server, and that server kept going down, and the person who ran the server was located in the UK, and we'd have to wait until he woke up for him to bring him back online. And we were like, well, this is kind of tiresome, so we'll just set up our own server. And that had a few thousand people in the server, funded partially via donations, and it was my first experience running online communities, essentially between 2011 and or so in 2014. And there were people, for example, who like became lifelong friends to the game server. There was even one couple who met and ended up having a kid after meeting on the server.
Wow.
Yeah. So just really saw like how like just creating this thing as a hobby could have a very real impact on people's lives. And that I think has inspired a lot of my future work, including Adventure Gold, realizing, oh, hey, even a small thing I put together can be hugely impactful for people in the world. So that oriented me a lot towards like small experiments, trying things out. Essentially not being afraid to just put something out there and see what happens, because the game server, you know, it grew to be a vibrant community. It taught me everything I know about Linux, everything I know about DevOps, everything I know about community management, all from, oh, the server keeps going down, and now we can play without needing to wait for UK hours to wake up. And funnily enough, the person in the UK actually was one of the first people I heard about Bitcoin from. He actually did a ton of Bitcoin mining back in the day. But I sadly did not jump aboard that ship. So I missed the Bitcoin mining wave. I played with CPU mining back in the day, but got basically nothing from it. And CPU mining, I had an NVIDIA card and not an AMD card, which was more detrimental for GPU mining. So I didn't
because
mind
the drivers are not it. Weren't open source at the time.
I think it was partially the drivers, and then partially AMD cards were much more optimized for hashing than NVIDIA cards. I don't recall the exact underlying reasons why, but everyone knew like equivalently powered AMD cards would have much better hash rates. So I did not go down the Bitcoin mining rabbit hole back in the day, but I had friends who did, and that likely worked out extremely well for them.
probably. Actually, speaking of the effects of small actions and sort of the early days of your involvement in Bitcoin, I talked to David Silverman of Lens Protocol and Aave the other day, and he mentioned that you showed him the Bitcoin white paper in 2014. How did you two meet?
Yeah. So Dave and I actually went to school together. We knew each other from school, and I had been volunteering for the Tor project at the time. They put out an open call for web developers, and I started working on essentially a portal that would auto-select the platform and language for you for the right version of the Tor network. So that was a small improvement to the download portal that I started working on. And then I told David about it, knowing that he also was interested in web development, and we started working on that together. It didn't end up launching, but it was a really great group of people working on it. And during that time, we were talking about decentralized technologies. I told them about Bitcoin, showed them the Bitcoin white paper, and yeah, that's been pretty incredible. Knowing the butterfly effects of these things is really truly remarkable. How just a few people hearing about the right thing at the right time can make a huge impact on their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not as familiar with David's work at Aave prior to Lens, but we did have a recent conversation on Web3 Galaxy Brain all about his PMing of the Lens protocol project in V1 and I guess some involvement in Aave's proprietary interface for Lens protocol as well. So pretty cool how far the rabbit hole goes. Pretty
it's a very small ecosystem for sure. Because I mean, even though the crypto ecosystem is very large, the ecosystem of builders is so small that it's really incredible to see where people end up.
Do you think that's unique to crypto, or if you work for Facebook or Google or whatever, is it actually there aren't that many people making the software either? Or is it just that crypto is so nascent that that's what makes it so much smaller?
Yeah, I think that the main thing in crypto is that building in crypto is probably one of the hardest ways to make money. You have a lot to maintain. You have a lot of people mad at you all the time. And for people who can do a lot of trading instead, that starts to look more appealing. So I think that probably it's mostly a function of take the sum total of people in crypto, and then some percentage of them want to do trading, really enjoy that. Some percentage of them want to do MEV, really enjoy that. And then some percentage of them want to build pure protocols and put them out into the world and have them be totally autonomous and self-sufficient, and then they go and do that. And then you look at the number of people remaining who want to build in crypto and who want to handle community building as well, and also want to handle the downsides of community management that come with having a token. And that's a pretty small number of people, especially when there are much easier ways to make money. So I think the upside of that is that all the builders in the space are really, really dedicated. Pretty much everyone I know who's a builder just absolutely loves it, and that's what they always want to do. I know other people who were early in crypto who burned out on certain aspects of it, but I think that builders have a lot more underlying passion for what they do and couldn't imagine doing anything else.
Yeah, it's definitely exciting. I guess we'll get right to it, right into the ups and the downs of building. And also another theme you mentioned earlier, which is kind of not worrying too much about knowing in advance where something is headed, but putting something out into the world sort of to see what kind of connections it creates. We have to talk about Adventure Gold. So where were you when Loot dropped?
Yes. So when Loot dropped, I was hiking in Oregon. So I never bring any of my hardware wallets with me when I go on trips. So I always leave it behind because I hope to be able to disconnect for a weekend or so. And I was hiking in Oregon without my ledger when Loot dropped. And I saw essentially a bunch of people talking about it on Twitter. Thought it looked really interesting. I remember hovering over the buy button on OpenSea for a collection of 20 Loot bags for one ETH, which I did not have the ETH available to buy at the time, because I didn't have my hardware wallet on me. But I thought that the primitive of Loot was very interesting, because I couldn't buy Loot with what I had available on me. I thought, well, I'll take a look at the contract instead. So I take a look at the contract and I see the composability of it. And I think, wow, this is a really interesting primitive. I wonder what happens if you plug in a in-game currency into this ecosystem. So I coded that up, and while waiting for a flight, I was at the airport for like 4 hours. It was a very long time in the airport, and there was like one shop with breakfast sandwiches. So I was basically just sustaining myself off of that as I was coding. And then I finished most of the code essentially that day, and then wrote some tests on the flight, and then kicked off community audits once I got back home, and also at that point bought some Loot bags because I finally had my ledger back on me. Yeah, I think it was very interesting. Not being able to start trading the bags meant I had to look more at the underlying details. The underlying details are actually really interesting. Side note, every time I don't bring my ledger, more often than not, something huge happens in the space. Last time I didn't bring my ledger with me when I traveled, there was the UST and Luna collapse. Oh, yeah, the bottom line is like, if I'm traveling without my ledger, you probably should like exit like most of your positions because something will happen or be ready to enter some position. Every time I'm like, oh yeah, it's just one weekend, whatever. It's just some of the most monumental events in crypto.
We need a Will Papper alpha Twitter account or something. Should let us know.
Yeah,
next
so I'll
time.
Just tell people when I'm going on vacation and then they can trade based on that. Yes.
I've got the Adventure Gold contract right in front of me. We should explain to people what it is in case they have somehow not heard about it, but it's all of 235 lines of code, including substantial comments, NAT spec comments. So it's not that much code and nevertheless quite an impactful contract. Maybe you want to tell people basically what it does?
Yeah, absolutely. So Adventure Gold essentially is an airdrop of an in-game currency to all loot holders. So every single loot holder could receive 10,000 Adventure Gold. They could claim that for their loot bag and they could use that any way they wished within the loot ecosystem. Some groups use that for governance. There was a group called Holy War for Loot that was using it to vote on storylines. Some groups use that to denominate NFT mints. Some groups use that as wagers for in-game battle. So it was essentially this primitive that I thought would be very interesting to put out there and see how people use it, because the whole spirit of loot is composability. And I thought, what happens to add this composable currency on top of loot? I wrote it in 4 hours. Most of the time I spent on it was on the actual mechanics of the code itself. If I had known how big it would get, I would have put more effort into tokenomics. But thankfully, there's an incredible community pushing forward Adventure Gold who have really helped put some solid tokenomics in place to help sustain it for the long term. So now it's in a really good spot.
Okay, I am curious about those tokenomics. I guess first let's talk about the mechanics. And you say you wrote it in about 4 hours, but I mean, it's not so basic. It's got, obviously, the fundamental mechanism is this claim function. So you can claim by ID or claim all for owner or claim range for owner, which are three mm-hmm. different ways of claiming 10,000 Adventure Gold per loot in the season zero, the first season of the Adventure Gold issuance. So anybody who has a single loot bag can claim 10,000 of these AGLD tokens. And then it includes, like, you know, aside from just those high level functions that I mentioned, which would allow someone with multiple loot bags to claim the AGLD they're owed for all of their bags or just a range of them or an individual one. There's other functions in here that are also pretty sophisticated. I mean, even just the concept of the seasons, the idea that the DAO that manages Adventure Gold could ultimately create other issuance events, as well as some other functions we can get into. So it's not so basic. I think for something so short and written so quickly, it's actually has quite a bit of forethought into what the mechanics might play out, you know?
Yeah. I think that part of the flexibility I built into it was because, of course, Adventure Gold was a side project. Of course, I work with a lot of DAOs in my day job at Syndicate, and single biggest thing that we DAOs tend to encounter is a lack of flexibility in tokenomics after being set up. That's the single biggest problem that they run into. So launch token, and then that token will need some changes, and then they'll need to do an entire migration, and it's a very, very messy process. I wanted to build that flexibility into the contract up front so that the parameters for Adventure Gold could be tuned over time. And that was something that I thought would be really, really interesting for the community to leverage so that they could adjust the tokenomics later on. So, for example, there's the DAO mint function that lets the DAO mint additional tokens. And that is what we'll use for staking, to be able to mint Adventure Gold tokens for staking and then transfer those to the staking contract. So the flexibility has been really, really useful. I wish that people use the seasons mechanic, which I can explain briefly for people.
Yeah, please
unless do. You want to run through the functions. Okay, sounds great. So essentially, I thought, okay, well, this one drop is interesting, but what if you could build in multiple different types of drops? So essentially, you can set a new season. So you could say, okay, there's a new Adventure Gold drop every month. for example, for loot holders, the idea being that they get a steady supply of adventure gold to go and spend in the ecosystem and use as they wish. You can also do things like change the amount distributed per season. So you could say the first season is 10,000, next month it'll be 1,000, month after that it'll be 100, and slowly reduce the supply.
Right.
One thing you can also do that I find to be really cool is I added support for changing the contract address that you want to use for the airdrop. So in theory, you could change the contract address from loot to more loot and give more loot an adventure gold airdrop of, say, 10 AGLD or 100 AGLD in a given season. And that's where adventure gold, in many ways, I view it as a unifier of the loot ecosystem. There's lots and lots of different projects in the loot ecosystem, and adventure gold is one way to unify them. I don't think that that ability to customize who can receive drops has been utilized to its full potential, but it's something that exists for the community to take forward if they desire.
Yeah, so we're talking about this DAO set loot contract address function, and the comments say, allows the DAO to set a new contract address for loot. This is relevant in the event that loot migrates to a new contract. But as you say, it could be used for pointing it at other loot style contracts. I guess it could even be pointed at something different that has more or less similar mechanics for internally tracking the tokens.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know that more loot would exist at the time. More loot was was an experiment that was launched. So it just so happened to be able to support more loot. And one point there was the rhetoric in the midst of the whole Adventure Gold, very, very hectic week of Adventure Gold, there was the rhetoric of like Adventure Gold has the potential to be the Bitcoin of the metaverse. And one thing that the community could do is they could essentially give a bunch of Adventure Gold airdrops to a bunch of different communities and use it as a unifier. So as long as it's an IRC 720 enumerable, which a fair number of NFT contracts are, in theory you could also wrap it anyway. You could wrap a non-enumerable contract in an enumerable contract. So bottom line is you could essentially point these airdrops at any community of your choosing and say, here's Adventure Gold for you, and Adventure Gold for you, and Adventure Gold for you. And then suddenly, if a whole bunch of people in the metaverse hold Adventure Gold, then it becomes a really important unifier and could become the common currency for any games or other ecosystems that people construct. That hasn't happened yet. So that's actually, interestingly, small digression, but really relevant, is that that's also one reason why I had very mixed opinions of forks of Adventure Gold. So, well, there were some forks that were pump and dump scams, but like, let's put those aside. The thinking was like, is Adventure Gold a unifier? And in which case it should be grouped around one DAO and that DAO helps build these bridges? Or should every community launch their own version of Adventure Gold and then they all have their own currencies? After Adventure Gold was released, it kind of sparked a whole movement of different groups launching their own Adventure Gold style tokens. Some using the Adventure Gold source code directly, some using source code that was heavily inspired by it. And I think that it's fascinating because in the loot community, there is a ideological split between, do we have a DAO to coordinate efforts, or do we just have completely decentralized initiatives where there's no central coordinating party and everyone can do as they wish? And I tried to construct Adventure Gold in a way to prove that DAO-style thesis, that having a DAO to coordinate things can be useful and can build bridges and can help groups coordinate their efforts better. That, I think, was hampered by the fact that if everyone's launching their own version of Adventure Gold itself is not going to be a unifying currency. Adventure Gold needs to be across communities to be a unifier.
Right. And I think it did become very associated with loot specifically. I know that there was discussion in the early post Adventure Gold days of loot where people were trying to decide if Adventure Gold should become a governance token of the loot ecosystem, or if even loot themselves should be or not. But the conversation did seem to circulate mostly around the topic of governing loot rather than being some kind of broader metaverse token in the spirit that it sounds like was close to your heart around the time of its invention.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that that's because the loot community was dealing with its own internal struggle over should loot be decentralized and permissionless, or should it have a DAO?
Yeah.
And I think Adventure Gold was very wrapped up in that same struggle, and it was hard to decouple it. I personally view Adventure Gold as an in-game currency that can be used by any ecosystem that wishes to adopt it. And I do think that there is potential for a community or dedicated group. I'm not speaking from like any particular knowledge, just a hypothetical here. Mm-hmm. A community or dedicated group to take it forward and essentially use it as a bridge building mechanism to say, hey, this NFT project, we're going to bring you into the fold. This NFT project, we're going to bring you into the fold. We're going to start to unify these groups. We're going to start to offer you grants. And in exchange for those grants, you give certain utility to Adventure Gold or certain perks to people involved in the ecosystem. I think that there's a lot of potential for that. I think that in general, crypto has a coordination problem. The incentives are very, very heavily weighted towards doing your own thing and accruing value to that, and not weighted towards collaborating within existing ecosystems. I think loot itself has been affected by that to some extent, where a lot of loot derivatives, essentially loot acts as a whitelist mechanism for it, and holding loot gets you into these derivatives first. But once those derivatives are launched, value tends to accrue to those derivatives and not back to loot. And I think that that kind of coordination is really, really difficult. And I think that the idea of decentralized and permissionless ecosystems with no coordination sounds really nice in theory, because anyone can try anything out. In practice, there were, for example, two different groups working on a new version of the Loot website, and they only realized that each other was working on it when they had both finished their own versions. Mm. In practice, decentralized structures with zero coordination tend to create a lot of duplicated effort and duplicated work, which is why I'm more in the Adventure Gold and Loot should be DAOs camp, and less in the these are ecosystem primitives that are completely permissionless. I obviously think that the permissionless aspect is useful, but it's necessary but not sufficient. It's something where the permissionless nature and adoption of it helps, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a DAO also trying to push forward adoption on their own, just like, for example, how Nouns is doing for the Nouns community, for example.
Yeah, it's interesting. To me, when Loot came out, it was really Nouns versus Loot, where it was the sort of spectrum. It seemed like Nouns was Nouns did take this approach of creating where each token is really a governance token in Governor Bravo fork designed for NFTs that manages this treasury where all the revenues from the Nouns sales are pointed, or the vast majority, I think even all, versus Loot, where free to claim, so no revenues on the primary sale initially, and at least for the first little while there were no royalties on the collection, although to my understanding at some point royalties were applied, and I don't know exactly who manages the DAO to which those are pointed. But I did see the appeal of keeping Loot as the sort of strong counter argument to Nouns. Like Nouns would be this more what we traditionally think of as a DAO managing this treasury, versus Loot as a completely governance free, yeah, almost not it would be incorrect to call it a protocol, but yeah, as you say, sort of a ecosystem primitive available to all, but with no particular revenue generation scheme. However, in practice, as I say, ultimately royalties have been applied to the collection. And as you note, there are many derivatives, if that's even the appropriate word, but many collections inspired by or somehow connected to Loot that have given free to claim or early access to new collections. So many of them, it's hard to even, I mean, the ones that come to mind are the Magic ecosystem on Arbitrum, or Loot Realms, so many different things. But the value does ultimately accrue within those other ecosystems, because of course, what's the point once you've sort of bootloaded with some other ecosystem, such as the loot holders? Ultimately, you want to create some kind of positive feedback loop within your own ecosystem, and forever servicing the loot holders maybe is not of any clear value to the new network. You could perceive of that as a problem, or you could perceive of that as a kind of solution. These are just sort of mechanisms for booting new ecosystems. But then ultimately, you know, I think a lot of people were very critical of Loot because it at least appeared on Twitter like there were a lot of VCs who were heavily invested in Loot. I don't know to what extent that's actually true quantitatively, but there are some investors who hold a significant number of Loot bags. And from my understanding is that the participation in derivative projects or projects that otherwise connect themselves to the original Loot bags is just not even worth their attention given the size of the portfolios that they manage. So all the Loot bags that are held by that type of collector investor generally go, the derivatives that are available to them generally go unclaimed because it's not even worth their attention from their perspective, which is a shame because it sort of puts a limit on how those derivative projects like Genesis Loot and the Mana, which is used for creating Genesis Adventurers, for example, a lot of it remains unclaimed because those participants in the Loot ecosystem are not bothered.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a strong history of investors that are kickstarting ecosystems, particularly for, like, you see this in the alt L1 space a lot, where they'll then fund a lot of tooling on top of those ecosystems. And I think that Loot could have been positioned the same way, where Loot is similar to an alt L1, and then a bunch of people who hold lots of Loot create grants vehicles or full funding vehicles. I was talking to people in the early days who wanted to quit their jobs and go build for Loot full time, and they were looking for funding to do so.
Did they have Loot bags, or what motivated them to want to do that?
Some of them had Loot bags, some of them didn't. And they just loved the idea of it. And they wanted, you know, that would have been a great use of the owner bags, for example, in the Loot ecosystem, or a great use of an ecosystem fund to help give them some of that upside in the Loot community. And I think that Loot didn't play out that way in the end. There's no reason why it couldn't have. It's just that the coordination problems are very, very hard. And I think the increase in value in the Loot NFTs caused there to be a significant scarcity mindset around them at the same time as when an ecosystem fund would have been developed. So I don't think that there's any reason inherently why that didn't happen. It's just that it's pretty hard to say, let's create an ecosystem fund and bring more people in the fold at the same time when people are voting to bring the keys to the Loot contract and ensure that no Loot bags can ever be minted again, which was the vote that eventually passed.
Right. Part of me thinks that the creating some kind of financial incentive for builders disincentivizes builders who don't receive the financial compensation grant or whatever it is for creating the project. I don't know. You can see it both ways. Obviously, people who want some kind of certainty and stability will seek out and or require greater capital in order to execute their plans, require that kind of funding. But at the same time, there has been a lot of projects that are in the Loot ecosystem and that continue to operate, but maybe less of the value would have escaped into those new tokens if there was consistent funding available that could be traced back to the original Loot collection. Although I do think, like many other NFT collections, the really rapid appreciation price of the Loot bags ultimately hurt the community. They haven't held their price long term, and that speculation, as you say, led to this kind of scarcity mindset that is not really productive of builders.
Yeah, and that's I think the biggest lesson to me from Loot is that there is a very significant divide between the perspectives of builders and the perspective of token holders. At the end of the day, token holders are liquid, and they, in many cases, they're operating on short time horizons and they care about maximizing short term value, whereas the builders care about maximizing long term value and in many cases are either illiquid or, in the case of, for example, like protocol treasuries, have such a percentage of the supply that, like, even though the token is liquid, like, they themselves are essentially illiquid because there's a even if they have a large treasury, there's not a way to reasonably deploy it.
They'd move the market if they started selling.
Yeah, or even started giving out significant grants in some cases, yeah. So I think that that's the biggest thing that the cryptocurrency space has to reconcile. Previously, I was pretty pessimistic about cryptocurrency's ability to reconcile that, but I think with the turn from the bull market to more of a bear market, I actually am now more optimistic that the crypto community can figure it out. You know, at the height of the bull market, deploying a new NFT contract would, you know, net people a few million dollars, and then they could just keep on going on and doing that time and time again. And some people have, and that's sometimes done in good faith of experimentation and sometimes done in bad faith of rugs. But like when things are in a bull market and everything is minting out, people don't need to focus on it as much. Whereas now that we're in more of a bear market and there's lots of projects that aren't minting out at the moment, even though they're part of great ecosystems, I think that now is the time where people are forced to focus on long-term value, both token holders and builders. One thing that's interesting, for example, with Adventure Gold is that the consensus view was that there would never be new Adventure Gold minted, that it would be a scarcity mindset and that all proposals to mint new Adventure Gold would fail. And then the staking proposal passed, and the staking proposal passed with an incredible majority, nearly unanimous, of the community supporting it. And I think that's because the community at that time had seen the initial hype of loot die down, and they were looking for utility. And at the end of the day, like, you do need utility, you do need usage. And that, I think, is something that people will start to look for in bear markets. So I think we have, who knows how long the bear market will last, whether it's a few months or a couple of years. But 2018 to 2020 in the crypto space was a really quiet time where people could dive really deep into creating long-term value with the infrastructure they're building, and Uniswap, Compound, and other protocols came out of those bear markets in a really powerful way. And I think that just like how the 2017 ICO boom had a ton of proposed DeFi and alt L1 protocols that went nowhere in the speculation, but then built strength in the bear market, I think that NFTs might look very similarly, where just like the 2017 ICO boom and then the bear market building period, I think a lot of the NFT projects will be abandoned or become illiquid. But I think that the ones that emerge will be as essential to the NFT space as Uniswap and Compound and similar DeFi protocols are to their space. So I don't know what that will look like. I don't think any of us can predict which projects it will be, whether those are existing projects or new ones. But I do think that bear markets are for builders is kind of a meme. I think that the very real truth within it is that when short-term speculation dies down, you need long-term value. And I think that the long-term value that comes out of the NFT space and various derivatives will be really, really fascinating to see.
Absolutely, yeah. We definitely see, I agree with you that a turn to utility in the bear market is bound to happen. I think some of the projects that have made collected huge war chests by promising things that it's unclear they'll ever be able to ship may ultimately be able to buy or build their way into something, if not exactly what they promised, something else that is of value. But I think there is a interest in some form of utility beyond further airdrops of exit liquidity opportunities. And we'll see. I think people still want to make money with NFTs, no doubt. But I think people are also interested in potentially new mechanics that offer something interesting, something new, something that has some depth to it beyond just the surface value and promises and stories. So we'll see. What you're saying reminds me to ask the question before we move on to Syndicate, which I definitely want to get into next. Is there anything about the AGLD contract that you would have changed, or maybe just its social positioning that you would have changed? Maybe, I don't know, immediately preloading it with a second season or a second contract outside of loot in order to predispose it for being this unifying force, perhaps?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think that one thing I would have done is instead of having a claim all at once, I would have had the claim vest, where you get a continuous airdrop of the tokens, and you can claim any within that time period. And that's something that I think would have made a massive difference, because the communities of loot and adventure gold holders diverged quite quickly. I believe someone pulled the stats, and around 55% of loot holders also held adventure gold in their wallets, which was pretty low, because there's people who had, for example, like bought loot that had already had the adventure gold claimed, as one example. Hmm. And that is something where having it vest at a continuous rate would have, I believe, made a massive difference of ensuring the loot and adventure gold communities stayed aligned. I do think also that, yeah, automatically triggering certain actions based on time periods would have been really fascinating. And I don't think I would have added any triggers besides, like, made any major changes besides token vesting. But what I think I would have done is I probably would have set up defaults that the community could override, where, for example, by default, a new season would start with a reduced amount after a certain period of time. Mm-hmm. And that could be overridden by governance vote. But I think that the contract was designed so that every decision went through governance. And instead of having the community approve everything, I think it would have been better to have the community have the option to veto instead. I think that essentially allowed by default and then vetoed by governance vote instead of essentially not allowed at all until a governance vote permits it, I think that would have created nice focal points for the communities to rally around.
I think defaults in DAOs kind of predefined governance through the defaults in the contract or whatever the mechanism is that's executing the DAO are very powerful. The one that I always think of is in Juicebox. All projects pay this currently 2.5% fee when extracting funds from their treasuries, and that fee goes to the Juicebox DAO, and in return issues JBX tokens, or tokens in the protocol, the underlying protocol atop which the project you're participating in is created. So every project becomes an owner of the protocol atop which it's built by default, no governance required. And I think that's very powerful for creating this potentially positive network effect between projects on the protocol and ownership of that protocol itself. So these kind of predefined relationships that can be built into DAO structures can come in various forms, and even something that maybe looks like a fee could actually be a form of pre-passed governance proposal to invest in the protocol on which you're building.
Absolutely. And I absolutely love the Juicebox approach. And I think that's a very, very interesting example, because I think that if Juicebox tried to pass a fee now with the governance structure, like a fee that's offset by governance tokens, I think that that vote probably would not succeed at this point. But by encoding it upfront and then giving the community parameters to tune, it's easier to set out a vision that the community can rally around. The idea of a protocol being owned by its users is a very core primitive in crypto that's very powerful. And I think the fact that Juicebox was able to set that vision in a smart contract and then say, if you want to, you can revoke this, is a more powerful way to guide people than saying, okay, let us all get together and decide if we want the protocol to be owned by its users via this fee mechanism.
We do live in a moment where people are almost afraid to have revenue. So it is interesting that that one was programmed in from the start.
Yeah. And I think that that's also something that NFT projects tend to have an advantage over ERC-20s for as well, is that NFTs have a really easy path to recurring revenue that can build up a treasury that can be deployed in all sorts of great ways to support the ecosystem.
Right.
Whereas ERC-20s, structurally, that's much more difficult. I think that Juicebox got that right structurally for an ERC-20. But I know of a lot of projects that prefer ERC-721s simply for royalty reasons.
For sure. One last question on AGLD. You mentioned the staking proposal. That was to issue more adventure gold. And then what was the staking element in that?
Yeah, so essentially you can stake your loot bags and then receive adventure gold. And the idea is essentially to have some skin in the game for the loot community. So we wanted to reunify the Adventure Gold and Loot communities and say, okay, the holders have diverged, but let's bring them back together again. Let's bring them all on one side. And we talked about various mechanisms, like you could, for example, signal a loot bag so that you could essentially like accrue a GLD by default. And then if you move it to a different wallet address, anyone can like verify that you've done so, and then essentially unsignal your bag for you, so to speak. We ended up building out staking mechanisms instead because that creates more skin in the game. You're essentially sedating that the way you want to use your loot bags is to stake it for Adventure Gold, which requires more active participation than just sitting back and accruing new claims whenever you wish. So it's definitely an interesting choice, one that I think will lead to the more active participants in the ecosystem getting more substantial claims, which is a good thing. But then, of course, the downside to gas costs. So it's an interesting trade-off, and it'll be fascinating to see how the community develops after that's ready.
So AGLD has really just been a side project, but really your main squeeze is Syndicate DAO. So what is Syndicate DAO?
Syndicate is the company I co-founded with my co-founder Ian. He and I met at IDEO in 2018, and I was working on R&D in their essentially R&D group, and he was setting up their crypto fund underneath their R&D group. We met through there and started brainstorming Syndicate. Essentially started brainstorming in 2018, and the idea behind Syndicate was to have a essentially fully decentralized investing network where your actions would speak louder than words, where you had an on-chain track record of your investing activity, where the deals you had access to and the you could invest in and protocols you could invest in started to be based much more what you've done rather than what you've said. And that democratizes investing for everyone because it makes it much more meritocratic. It's not who has the most Twitter followers, it is who has done the most for the startups that they work with. And we started brainstorming that in 2018, but it was way too early, way too early. At that time, there were some GameFi experiments in the space with CryptoKitties and others, and that was most activity in the space. There was also a bunch of enterprise blockchain work going on all the time, but DeFi barely existed, and there really wasn't much capital or activity on the Ethereum network itself. And then after DeFi summer in 2020, there was more capital in the network, and we started to realize, oh wow, Syndicate is finally viable now. So then we decided to go full-time on Syndicate the beginning of 2021, and then have built it up since then. We just hit numbers always are higher every time I check. So I always check in real time. So we've crossed 2,800 investment clubs on Syndicate, and we launched publicly on January 25th. So it's been around that day, give or take a day or two. So it's been quite the time in the world over the past few months.
Congratulations. So I guess to give people a quick idea of what Syndicate does, if I wanted to start an investment club, what would I do with Syndicate? If I wanted to, I guess, join together with some friends that I know IRL and do some investing, how would I?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you can set up an investment club for any topic or any community you'd like. So you could, for example, say we are setting up an investment club for on-chain art, and we're all going to pool funds together. So we set up a DAO on Syndicate. That DAO can take deposits, manage members, give out distributions, provide transparency to the community. We'd essentially say, let's set up a DAO on Syndicate. We'll all deposit funds into it. That can be ETH, that can be USDC, that can be any ERC20 if you're choosing. And then we can invest that into projects that we care about. So maybe we're going to buy up mass castles, and we're going to buy up loot, and we're going to buy up loot maps. And the idea is that it helps communities invest together very, very easily. And it also helps you, in addition to helping you on the protocol side with DAO, with a fully customizable DAO infrastructure that you can build on top of, it also helps you a ton on the legal and compliance side too. There's still a lot of things in the Web2 world that people have to deal with, whether that's forming legal entities to reduce individual liability, or whether that's things like paying taxes. So we provide everything you need for an investment club on both the protocol layer, and then also we can help a lot with the legal and compliance side as well.
Very cool. I know you can basically spin up an LLC in order to wrap these investment DAOs, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, you can actually do something really cool with our platform, which is you can link the ownership of the LLC to the token holdings. So you can state through our legal documents that the token holders are the legal owners of the LLC, which is incredibly cool. So people are like, how do you handle the distinctions between corporate entities and DAOs? In the context of investment DAOs, know that this does not apply to community DAOs. Community DAOs are a whole another different angle. But in the context of investment DAOs, you can simply say it's both. The token is the ownership of the legal entity. They're not separate, they're combined. And that's something that's really cool, and we're really happy about that as a DAO native solution. Ideally, compliance like fades into the background, and it's not something you need to worry about. It's something we handle easily and help you with, and something where if you just follow a few steps, you'll be in a good spot.
Do you have to impose limitations on transferability of the tokens to achieve that?
By default, yes, the tokens are non-transferable, and then transfers would run through the DAO itself. Essentially, if you wanted to transfer it, say, to a new wallet or to a friend, you would essentially have the manager of the DAO. That can be a multi-sig, that can be an individual, that can be on-chain governance. Usually it's a multi-sig that would then burn the tokens from your wallet and mint the tokens from the new wallet. That being said, the transferability settings are completely customizable under the hood. Syndicate's built an entire developer platform underneath that backs all of our DAOs, and we are documenting that right now for third parties to build on top of. So if you consult with your own legal counsel and decide that enabling transferability is fine for your use case, you can do so. You can also build extensions on top of any sort of mint rules, transfer rules, burn rules that you'd like for your own functionality. So that developer platform is something we're working on very actively. We have a few groups that are testing it in private beta as we continue the documentation and iron out the details. And then we'll have that widely accessible to everyone to build on top of. Not entirely sure when it will be released quite yet, but as soon as possible, we'll have it widely accessible to everyone to build on top of and use as they wish.
Do you have a sense of what kind of projects would make sense to you to build on top of Syndicate?
Yeah, so I think the lowest hanging fruit for sure is people who want to build certain different spins on investing DAOs. So for example, they wanted to, for example, have specific communities that they want to make the investing DAOs accessible to. Like we have token gating available coming soon, but maybe they want to push that even a step further and have like different policies for how much different communities can invest or when they can invest, things like that. You could also build out custom reward schemes, for example, on top of Syndicate, where you could use our developer platform to say, okay, here's the rewards infrastructure we're going to build out. If you help in these ways, you get compensated with additional ownership of the DAO, which is essentially ownership over the investments. You could use it as a generalizable platform if you wanted to. So if you wanted to set up like ERC-20s for other purposes, you could do so. It's not really designed for that out of the box, but you could customize it as you see fit. So the infrastructure itself is very generalizable, and the use cases that make the most sense is extensions on top of investment DAOs, but you could use it any way you see fit. You could back it with on-chain governance. You could integrate it into really cool tooling and communities like Juicebox. The infrastructure itself is something that we want the entire ecosystem to leverage if it's a good fit for them.
So essentially, Syndicate gives you some of these legal affordances that are built into the infrastructure, and also some infrastructural affordances that allow you to collectively own investments, and I suppose divvy up or otherwise collectively manage the proceeds from them?
Exactly. So for example, let's say, like here's another cool thing you could do. It's like, let's say you could say like for DAOs that are community DAOs, maybe you need a legal entity for certain things like hosting events. or paying contributors. And maybe you could, for example, link the DAO's legal entity to the signers on a multisig or other individuals who are trusted. And then maybe the community itself can govern who's on the multisig. So you can essentially get really interesting layers of transparency and accountability by linking the customizable DAO infrastructure we've built with the legal entity. But yeah, in the most basic form, you can use it as an investment club and handle deposits, member management, distributions, all inside of Syndicate. But you can extend any of those components out as you see fit or integrate it with any other ecosystem tooling to take it beyond what we've built if you want to.
Very cool. We talked a little bit before the show, and you mentioned that maybe one of the more interesting elements from a mechanistic Solidity perspective is how Syndicate approaches upgradability and its overall architecture. Is there anything you can tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a lot of really interesting lessons about upgradable contract infrastructure. So we landed on an architecture we're very happy on, and I hope that the architecture becomes more standardized in space. So essentially, we started out building out a contract infrastructure that used the Open Zeppelin upgradable packages. And that was our starting point, was, okay, we have this upgradable contract infrastructure. And like this was our V1 when we were newer to Solidity. And we were like, oh, we have this upgradable contract infrastructure and it sets up a proxy contract. And then we can upgrade things as we see fit and swap out logic and learn as we go about what users need to build those features in. And that's great. So we started out with the Open Zeppelin upgradable contract infrastructure, and then we saw that it was a surprisingly brittle architecture. So one example is that you need to reserve all of the storage slots that you might want to use in advance. We did so. We had done so, but it's one example of if you don't consider things very carefully, you can run into issues. And then in addition to reserving extra variables that you might need, if you swap the order of any of those variables by mistake, you can end up with corrupted data.
So this is basically the problem with delegate call and presuming that the variables in the proxy, if they're named the same as the variables in the delegate, will actually overwrite, when in fact it's actually the order in which they're declared in storage that is...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Precisely. And Open Zeppelin has scripts that will help with this, but those scripts are tuned for a particular infrastructure. Like, for example, it's built for Truffle and Hardhat. I'm not sure if they have scripts for Foundry, which is what we use internally. And then essentially, like, you have a lot of checks writing on those scripts. So like the weakest link in your infrastructure is scripts that are checking your storage layout for consistency, which there have been bugs in storage layout upgrades that have led to protocols being vulnerable. So we realized, oh wow, the upgradable contract pattern is pretty brittle, a lot more brittle than we expected. It seemed like it was a lot of pluses, but it's actually comes with a lot of trade-offs, and the risk of storage layout corruption is not a risk we want to take. So we then looked at the data separation pattern. So the data separation pattern is mostly used by Gemini Dollar, and it basically is where you take a standardized interface, like an ERC20, and then you add in your own logic underneath. And then the interface will always remain the same, but you can add whatever logic you'd like, and you separate the logic from the data so that you can essentially swap in new logic but keep the data stored the same. And that was something we started pursuing, and we went pretty deep into working with the data separation pattern. So you can upgrade the logic easily, but each storage contract is immutable. So you end up with data separated among multiple smart contracts that you have to reconcile. And doing migrations of data is very, very difficult, especially in a gas-efficient way. So in the Open Zeppelin contract patterns, you had brittle data handling via storage slots. In the data separation pattern, you have brittle data handling via the immutable storage contracts. And even though the logic is swappable, when the data itself is pretty brittle, that actually that puts you in a position where the architecture added a lot of overhead and added a lot of brittleness without a ton of corresponding flexibility, because it was very difficult to add new variables or migrate data without deploying entirely new contracts and then adding those back into the previous logic contract. So it's an architecture that works really well at the beginning, but then becomes quite hard to maintain. And then at long last, we finally saw the light and independently came to our own modular architecture. There's a number of groups that use modular architectures. Zora is one, Tribe uses one, Maker uses one. We came to our own independently, but the implementation is broadly similar to other modular architectures. And modular architectures are amazing. I absolutely love them. They essentially give you all of the benefits of some of these upgradable patterns without the brittleness. So for anyone who might be unfamiliar with modular architecture patterns, so essentially you keep a very minimal core, and that core has certain predefined functionality, and then you have a large library of modules that are deployed as separate contracts. And then those modules, you can point to any version of the module you want to use. Just to recap, so Open Zeppelin, upgradable pattern, you have brittle storage layouts, and a big risk if you accidentally even swap a variable, for example, and redeploy without going through the full script workflow or without having the scripts pick it up. Data separation pattern, you'll end up with flexible logic, but extremely inflexible data. With modular architecture, it's wonderful. You get flexible logic and flexible data because these modules can hold data internally as well. So it makes state management much, much easier. And then the benefit, to top it all off, is that this modular architecture is extremely easy to read and very transparent to communities in a way that upgradable contracts via the Open Zeppelin upgrade patterns, the data separation pattern, might be less transparent or less maintainable. So we absolutely love modular architectures. I am pretty firmly convinced at this point that most of the problems people are trying to solve with upgradable contracts actually should be solved with modular architecture. It's simpler to implement. It carries less risk. It is far easier to govern via DAO infrastructure. And I'm just a huge fan of it in general.
So just to clarify, to make sure I'm understanding correctly, in the modular style architecture that you're describing, a contract would have a storage variable with a contract address that is mutable and could be updated in the future. And then functions such as internal functions within this contract would be calling out to that other address, which is that other contract, which is in storage and could be updated, replaced with some other contract. An example might be something like the corruptions NFT, where people were able to corrupt their NFTs and Dom was periodically changing what corruptions contract was updating the metadata. Is that a good example? Is that roughly
precisely?
Summarized? Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly it. And swappable renderers is actually something that is a really nice example of it. Where let's take the corruptions contract. You have an initial renderer and that has some logic in it, but you might want to change it later on. You can then deploy only a new renderer. Everything else stays the same. Then you change the pointer to the renderer, and then you're good to go. And the modular architecture also, in like, it's, so you can put state in the modules if you want to. Sometimes it ends up being easier to do so. But the nicest implementations, the cleanest implementations, these modules don't maintain any state. The state is maintained by the main contract, which means that swapping out, for example, an NFT renderer, if that renderer doesn't contain any state, is incredibly easy and incredibly flexible. So it lets you move very quickly, not need to worry about data migrations and storage slots in the Open Zeppelin upgradable patterns. And it means that you don't need to worry about immutable data in the data separation pattern because you're not storing any state in the modules most of the time. You can if you have to, but it's not great. If you keep the state out of the modules and inside the main contract, you, as long as you know what the core of your application looks like, you can determine a lot later on with modules that get steadily more complex.
Right. So I'm not sure exactly how corruption is needed, but my sense from looking at the contract just now is that there's a single metadata address for the whole of the contract, which can be updated and which token URI references. But I've also seen other implementations, like a developer named Remnant on this project, the Reliquary, put together ERC 721 ATM, he called it, which allows the dev, the owner of the contract, to update the metadata, but allows token holders to revert their specific token to use a prior metadata contract. So there's also options like this where you can have a mixture of upgradability and also sort of an opt-out function. In the case of an NFT, it makes particular sense.
I love that. And I love that because it's something where for example, the upgradable proxy patterns, you do need someone to run those scripts via OpenZeppelin's deployments, and it's something that it's best managed by a team, and it's pretty risky to give to a community. Whereas with modular architecture, anyone, for example, could simulate very easily what the new renderer would look like, and it's very, very, very easy to run it through governance. So I think modular architectures are probably the most decentralized way to write Solidity contracts, because it's very easy for any community member to model the effects of swapping one module for another, especially when these modules are stateless. That makes it so straightforward because you don't need to worry about how it might interact with data that's already there. You can simply diff the old logic from the new logic and then know that know all the changes that will be made.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's just easier to wrap your mind around, which seems like an advantage all around.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the architecture. I think it should be more widely known and more widely adopted. I think that just like there's not that much documentation on it, frankly, because it's still pretty early. We document a lot of our modular architecture in our developer docs, and we're excited to release that and help other people understand the power of modular architectures. But yeah, I think that it's something where, like, if you Google how to make flexible smart contracts, you'll be led to upgradable contract patterns, not realizing that there's options that are much simpler while being more flexible and easier to audit.
One other question I had for you, given all this experience in building a whole protocol, is about engineering management of Solidity teams. I know from talking to you previously that you've learned a bunch from building this huge project, as well as I'm sure from AGLD and just observing in the scene otherwise. Do you have any insights to share that might be relevant for people who are sort of getting the hang of Solidity, maybe even quite experienced in thinking about how to manage larger projects with multiple devs collaborating?
Yeah, I mean, at Syndicate, we've definitely scaled to be a company with well over 30 people, and a substantial percentage of the engineers in the team are working on the protocol. So it's definitely a protocol we need to coordinate. One thing is, I mean, I can't sing its praises enough. Modular architectures help with that in a significant way. It ensures that people don't need to touch core parts of a contract, but can instead write new modules for new functionality. So it ensures that changes are much more self-contained, which reduces risk pretty substantially. I also think that the mindset for Solidity engineering teams is very different than mindset for Web2 engineering teams. A lot of Web2 engineering teams need to spend a lot of time on maintenance. For example, on our front end, we had a version that was set up with a V1 protocol, and then we rewrote a lot of it to work with our V2 protocol. 3 weeks later, the dependencies on the V1 protocol front end had changed, and the front end would no longer build. We hadn't touched anything. It was just the underlying infrastructure that had changed.
Oh, no.
and parts of it had become deprecated. Whereas the protocol, on the other hand, the front end was updated in 3 weeks. The protocol is on chain and will run forever. As long as Ethereum exists, the protocol will exist and will be able to be run. I think that the traditional engineering mindset focuses a lot on maintenance, less on documentation, and less, to some extent, on discrete components. Microservices architectures kind of are that, but like less on discrete components in general. Whereas if you have a module architecture in Solidity, you can just put up new modules as building blocks. And then as long as those are really well documented, those can be used by anyone forever. So immutability is in many ways a feature and a bug. The feature is that it means that you can develop rapidly with zero maintenance. The bug, of course, is that, if there are any actual bugs, you can't change it. The contract itself, you can only swap out the logic via a new module. So what does the engineering cadence of a Web2 team look like? It looks a lot like you spend most of your time maintaining the legacy code. You spend most of your time modifying an existing code base. You spend less of your time on documentation. You spend less of your time on testing. That, I think, would be standard in a Web2 code base. And you tend to see that a lot, where it's much more focused on, okay, I'm either adding a new feature, or I'm maintaining an existing one, or I need to go back and clean up some tech debt to get this new piece implemented. Whereas in Web3, you can write new modules all day long and keep deploying them. And the focus is much more on getting it right up front, with the knowledge that if you get it right up front, then the maintenance burden is effectively zero. So I think that that's something that holds back, for example, front-end teams or teams that in general are operating on infrastructure that very quickly becomes deprecated, like JavaScript-based infrastructure, where you know that you'll always need to touch new parts of your application when dependencies change, and you'll need to make updates and modifications. So nothing's ever really done.
Right.
Whereas in the Web3 world, once a module is complete, you deploy it, and as long as it's documented very clearly, anyone can use it at any point in time in the future, and your architecture starts to look more like these immutable Lego blocks and less like effectively managing dependencies before they get deprecated.
Even if your dependencies, ultimately you're depending on the browsers, which are themselves changing all the time.
Yes.
Presumably the wallets too are also going to be causing trouble long-term. I totally agree with you. I am curious if some of the post-merge state management stuff, which I'm not familiar with the details of, but my sense is that over time, sort of Ethereum will move to becoming a network where not everything is available as if it were in memory. And there may be some changes that make it so that some of the assumptions we're making today about availability of state in the future may not be true in the exact same way. But in any case, yes, definitely. Once I think this is the thing that people who aren't building in Web3 maybe don't appreciate, that it's really not possible to make a comparison between AWS or any kind of cloud provider and Ethereum or any chain that is sufficiently like Ethereum where you can just ship the code in. Walk away, and it will really just stay available.
Yeah, when I deploy various prototypes on AWS, you know, I might have deployed them half a decade ago, and I get emails every few months saying this piece is deprecated, this piece is deprecated, and usually they give you a pretty long timeline for the deprecation. But you know that at some point it'll be shut down. It's like, what? I'm going to dig into a 5-year old prototype code base because I need to migrate it from to a newer version of Python. Whereas in the Web3 world, just the mindset shift of maintenance becomes zero is just absolutely mind-boggling. That's why I'm a huge, huge fan of experimentation in the Web3 space, and why I think prototyping in the Web3 space is really important, because write once, run forever is something that means that any prototype you create or any experiment you create will always remain useful to people. No matter how long it is. In the Web2 world, if you put 20 prototypes out there, a year later, probably a quarter would be deprecated and broken in some way. And, you know, 3 years later, probably half would be broken. And then like 10 years later, probably all of them would be broken. Third-party APIs go down, stop being maintained, underlying cloud services get deprecated, languages get deprecated, and move to new versions. Whereas in the Web3 world, if you put 20 prototypes out there a decade later, assuming that the EVM retains backwards compatibility, all 20 prototypes will still be running perfectly, just like they were on day one. That is just mind-boggling in terms of the permanence of the software. On the one hand, immutability has a slightly negative connotation, but another way to phrase it would be permanence, and that permanence is an absolutely beautiful thing, because as long as a backwards compatible EVM lasts, which hopefully will be for an extremely long time, you will always have permanence and your software will always be running. That is just completely incredible. And I don't think there are any other points in software history where that property of permanence has ever existed until Web3, which is just absolutely amazing.
Absolutely. People who complain about the gas price maybe don't fully recognize what they're actually buying with the gas. Although at the same time, depending on the price of ETH 50 years from now, we may regret some of the things we put up. But I think it's interesting it's interesting what you point out, because it reminds me a lot of another project I really like in the space right now, JokeDAO. I spoke with Sean McCaffrey and David Phelps recently, and I think one insight that they've really sort of put an emphasis on is that you can have things like the JokeDAO governance contests, the joke contests that they put together, and those can be based on votes that are based on a fungible token, this joke token, that or an NFT or whatever it might be, that's actually really disposable, and they can be strewn across all kinds of different chains potentially. And some efforts like that may ultimately be things that are written to Ethereum and available for the long term. Some may be really temporary, disposable kinds of things. But having access to the ability to create things that are permanently available and yet frivolous potentially is a really cool mixture of properties. It doesn't mean that everything needs to be perfect. And so I really like that you're bringing in this idea of prototyping and the value of prototyping in that space, because with the Web2 sensibility and not having access to something to be able to create something so permanent and forever available, one might think that that means that you have to be really overwrought in your design and really careful. But actually, there is the opportunity for things like the upgradability that we spoke about, or the composability that AGLD is a great example of in the Loot ecosystem, that make it possible to do things that are an interesting effort. And then maybe we learn something from it and put out some contract that's interacting with it or dependent upon it in the future, without having to have known everything up front.
Absolutely. And that's what I think I'd close with, is that the power of cryptocurrencies and the powers of being a builder on top of a blockchain network, yes, it's decentralization. Yes, it's permissionless. But really what you get is permanent composability. That is absolutely unheard of. That has never existed before. And the more that we move on chain, as L2s come into place and gas costs go down, the more that we have that is permanent. So that's probably my best case for being a builder in Web3, is that you have an incredibly unique primitive where never before in history could you rely on these guarantees from other software that will always remain guarantees until now. And the more and more you move into this world that is guaranteed with verifiable commitments that will be permanent and always present, the more that you move into this on-chain world, the more the whole ecosystem thrives in the long term. I do think that it will be probably common to see blockchain software running autonomously for decade-long time spans, where you write a smart contract and it becomes useful infrastructure and it's run for decades. In terms of the Web2 software that has survived for decades in its original form, that's probably a vanishingly small number, maybe some GNU tools at most. That's probably most of the software that's survived with the same level of utility for an extremely long time period. But I think that at some point we will see smart contracts that have run for over 100 years. That obviously will take a while, given that Turing complete smart contract infrastructure only came into existence a little over half a decade ago. But there is no reason why a smart contract cannot run for a century. And the thought of that happening seems impossible without blockchain networks, but it's suddenly possible with them.
If that doesn't get you excited and ready to get out there and deploy some contracts, I don't know what would. No better note to end on. Will, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and chatting about all these different contracts, ideas, and really leaving us with a super inspiring message. Makes me want to open up Remix, open up Foundry, get going.
Thank you, Nicholas. This was fantastic, an incredibly fun time. Wonderful to chat as always, and I'm looking forward to seeing you soon.
Same. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Solidity Galaxy Brain. I put extensive links to the topics we discussed in the show notes. Links to subscribe to the podcast are available at soliditygalaxybrain.com. You can keep up with me on Twitter @Nicholas with four leading N's. Until next time.